Hello and welcome back to our podcast. A fanfic of a fanfic that itself is a synthesis of Fallout, the popular game about a post-apocalyptic wasteland, and My Little Pony, a popular show about pastel horses. Fucked up one thing in it like I always do. Hello, I'm Fi. That's weird. Say hello, weird.
That would be Sir Weirdington Esquire. I am immune to bullets and can turn people into stone, and I can fly.
Starting right away with the references. That's fantastic. Besides, you're a jukebox. What are you talking about?
You have no conception of the full capabilities of
a jukebox to surpass Metal Gear. Yeah, so hey folks, hey, we're welcome back. We're alive again. We're doing the thing. We're continuing our trend of doing two chapter episodes because of the incredible banality, I think is a good word for it. Yeah, incredible banality of the text for the next handful of chapters, and I just really want to rush through them as fast as possible.
In this week's recap, I basically can remember almost nothing.
Oh, good.
Like, I remember that, okay, the first chapter, they fought some dragons and secured a new character, very important, sunglasses.
Sunglasses.
Wait, okay, they saved some children?
Yes, and they saved some more crusaders.
Oh, God. Okay.
Yeah, the nihilist tots.
The next generation of ponies is going to be composed exclusively of nihilist.
Yes.
Murderous of angles?
Yeah, it actually occurs to me, we have not yet met a single child that wasn't a crusader in this story so far. So as far as we know, all children ever in this story are all nihilist crusaders.
Great! The future is bright. It's so bright that luckily we murdered some dragons for these shades. And in the chapter after that, we find out some interesting. Okay, the zebras who were the antagonist in the nuclear war that led the setting to where it is are totally not Muslim XPs.
Yes,
who have apparently divided racial loyalties among them, and that there are good guy zebras who engaged in a magical equivalent of skin bleaching. To show that they're the good ones.
Yes.
We find out that zebras were motivated by religious or were motivated by a weird nihilistic religious cause. We also find out there are still some in the world looking to continue the war. And we meet one of the big four, what we're kind of led to assume are the top threats in the setting currently, the mm-hmm. top four executive branch of the Reavers, the Ravengers, the Renegades, the Renabads,
the Bandits, the Murderers,
the Robads. I will insist on calling them because all of the most powerful among them are cyborgs. So we meet one of the four Robads, Gorgon, who has all the powers, all the best powers, and is ultimately shoved into a mineral grinder
in the mine? A rock crusher to crush him like a rock because he was so bulletproof that nothing could hurt him besides.
Well, it worked for the original Terminator. That's how Sarah Connor dealt with that problem.
If he had a thumb, he'd be pointing it out as he's being melted.
No, that was the second one.
Yeah, you're not wrong.
I'm the best kind of right, pedantically right. I'm sure Somber would be proud.
Somber and the rest of this community would be very proud about your pedantry.
that ran over me like a wave of something unpleasant. So what were the perks our hero gained?
All right, let's get to that in my notes. Chapter 8, was it? She gains the perk rad resistance because she's like become so exposed to radiation on a regular basis that she's starting to build up a tolerance for it. And in chapter 9, because of taking that bullet, I guess.
Oh right, it ended with the not a jihadi, sniping her in the chest.
Yeah, and she gains tough hide because I guess she's like more resilient to bullets now that she's had one in her. The whole gag of this, folks, is to really, like, hammer down that perks don't make any fucking sense in a story like this. Like, they add basically nothing to the narrative to do this.
True fact, I was once hit by a car, and I knew immediately after that.
And now you're stronger for it.
While I was lying, like, in the hospital bed, like, delirious and, simultaneously wandering the dreamscape and being aware of my broken form, I knew. Like, I was able to check my character cheat sheet and see that Kara's like autoimmunity had been added to one of my feat list. I now have like a +2 against reflex saves and fortitude saves against like bleeding out after when being menaced by a vehicle traveling in excess of 30 miles an hour. So like, no, that's true in life. Like that makes sense.
Yeah. That's just science.
Especially like I point this out mainly because I am deeply amused by the notion of Blackjack, like bleeding out, like wind knocked out of her, like barely able to breathe with a sniper bullet lodged in her rib cage. I bet she feels real tough right now. Like I bet her hide feels real tough.
That is an excellent way for us to jump into chapter 10. Chapter 10, Annie Up, like the poker thing. So we begin with actually pretty interesting, like in my opinion, like descriptive scene. Like you're gonna call it out for the fact that it's ridiculous pastel horses, but like,
You don't know. You can't predict me. You can't like.
It's a scene of Blackjack going into shock as like the whole scene starts to slow around her because she's now has a bullet wound deeply lodged in her chest, and everyone's sort of it actually does a pretty decent job of kind of like emulating this interesting sort of dreamlike quality where like she's sort of dipping out of consciousness in a way that like sort of feels right, I guess, to me reading it. So they have to try and like defibrillate her back, and there's this sort of like cool scene where she's like dipping out of consciousness and she's like sort of hallucinating what she assumes the afterlife to be, which is just like an endless, like basically endless Van Gogh night sky painting that she's like sort of like enchanted by and like want, like that she wants to be part of that, and therefore like she in her like dying state she like really aware that like that's what's going, like that would be death to be in that endless dark star expanse. This metaphor is used like a multiple of times in later parts of the story of like the stars being part of the like afterlife. So like it's kind of actually a cool theme to address, and it's like one of those few times where I can kind of like just sort of unironically say like, oh, this is a cool thing that Sabu wrote. But yeah, they defibrillate her. Pretty much the entirety of chapter 10, BJ is pretty laid out. Like this chapter is really inconsequential outside of this one sort of interesting scene because she just spends the rest of it being patched up in the like library while the story just kind of like moves at a snail's pace. We get a little exchange during the fever state of Gloria and 21 bickering that Gloria should just go back to the Enclave and get medical supplies, and she insists that she can't because the Enclave have like a lockdown on the sky and they'll kill anybody that tries to like fly up there without the proper credentials, which is something entirely made up for this story. Like that's just not the case in the original story, sort of. It's not, they don't have like total dominion over the sky. It's just sort of like, so it's just,
Also like, wait a minute. When did we establish that? Like she's a total renegade. Like she was given clearance to go down. Like she wasn't given a re-entry visa. Like she is not expected to ever, like she knows for a fact that she's not expected to come back.
there's kind of a thing made that she's supposed to report to her superiors in a place called Skyport, which is an area that they have cleared for like airplane travel, essentially. And she's supposed to report to them.
Wait a minute. New questions. Wait, why would a people innately capable of flight, like, wouldn't
have planes?
Wouldn't they like disdain artificial flight as like giving unicorns and vile earth horses like
the capacity to compare? So I guess to talk about the deep technological lore of this story, there's two kinds of primary forms of flight in the story that aren't just Pegasi flying. I think they're called whirligigs, which are helicopters essentially, and those work purely on like those were invented by Earth ponies, and those aren't like okay because they artificially like change like level the playing field. But there are special kinds of flying devices called vertibucks, and there's bigger than that, but vertibucks are the most primary ones. Are you struck by the fact that they're called vertibucks?
I can't not imagine a deer with its antlers twirling like helicopter blades. So, like,
there's also like in the past they also had things like called sky wagons, which were just like they were basically just like transports that had like magic on them that allowed like if a Pegasi, because Pegasi have inherent magic too. It just never talked about in the story, but like Pegasi, if it interacts with their like inherent flight magic to make the entire like wagon essentially flightless if they're hooked up to it. So they were used as like transport systems, and there's like they're basically cars in the story, but vertibucks are basically military vehicles, and then it goes up from there. And those are okay because they're entirely Pegasi powered to fly, so it's not considered unnatural by like the Enclave standards.
But anyway, arbitrary new rule invented to artificially raise stakes.
Yeah, Glory can't fly for no good reason. Yeah, BJ spends a chunk of this story in a bizarre metaphorical dream state poker game that I would never bring up if it didn't matter. But this is incredibly relevant for stupid reasons. So she plays a poker game with basically like. Her all her chips are metaphorical people that she's sacrificed to like stay alive or whatever, and she's playing against this like the dealer who's like a skeletal cowboy, and he's the stupidest character in this whole fucking story. Like, I've kind of teased here and there about the fact that like to my co-host that if you didn't hate Deadlands before, this story will make you hate Deadlands. This cowboy skeleton horse is part of that. So stay tuned.
I'm girding my loins. Yeah. That was that sound.
We get a little bit more backfill about the fact that this mine was being controlled by Sanguine. It's more references to this character who's Deus's boss, and apparently Gorgon was also working for him as well. That's which is why he was in the mine in the first place. He's planning some big thing, and no one seems to really have like a beat on what he's trying to do. We get an incredibly stupid exchange between 21 and BJ, where 21 blames himself for the zebra killing everybody because he just noticed something suspicious about him, and then didn't think to say anything because he didn't think it was that big of a deal. So it's cool to find out that 21 has the same stupid martyr complex that BJ has, but 21 is immediately forgiven for this transgression, which is like not surprising because 21 is the actual self-insert.
He is always right. His job is to be always right.
Yep. Like they like we've been calling on the stud is always right, but like the story, like BJ is basically like you're super smarts didn't figure this out. Like, oh, whoa, is me. Like, he basically called it out. And this exchange has this ending shitty line where she's like admiring 21's ass as he leaves, and it's just like, I forgot that this line is in the story. Like, I forgot that there's so much like there's actually like so much flirting between these two characters, and it's incredibly disgusting because of the point I keep making that fucking 21 was a bonded like breeding horse. Like, he wasn't like it's super fucked up to be writing this story to pitch it as if they're like should have a romantic like relationship. It's really really garbage. I hate it. Like, I never realized how much of the story is dedicated to making these characters end up. We get BJ and Glory have a conversation because Glory like operated on BJ and pulled the bullet out of her. And they're like, well, you know, for a medical technician, you sort of know how to do surgery. And we get this really shitty, like lampshade on the problem we've been talking about by calling her Dr. Professor or Horse Bony. She's some sort of ridiculous prodigy. Like, she's the cliche of a person so smart she had, like, her master's and doctorate before she was, like, turned of age kind of thing. Like the cliche of the gifted child that blows through.
That sounds like a wonderfully well socialized person.
Well, admittedly, Glory is incredibly socially like stunted. Like, yeah. She doesn't like she's incredibly literal and doesn't get like context or humor. Like she BJ constantly makes innuendo that like and Glory just like doesn't get it and has to be explained the joke multiple times. So like at least it's like valid within her characterization. Yeah. It's just really. It's frustrating to just have a like. It's a frustrating cliche, I guess, is my problem. Like, I hate the.
I mean, personally, I'm indifferent to it. Like, I like. Yeah. That's one of those things where I can just go, yeah, no. Like, I mean, audience, dear listener, and Phi, all of you. When I call out Dr. Professor, Dr. Professor MPhD. Mm-hmm. It's not entirely out of spite. It's a loving sort of spite. It's dumb and it's played out, but it has its role. Like there's a reason it exists, fair. And it's fine.
We do get a bit of nice back and forth between BJ and Glory, with Glory sort of opening up about her past because she's very like. She's very secretive about the Enclave and its nature for protective reasons. We learn a little bit about like characters that she knew that will become relevant later chapters, but like they're not important really right now. Then we get to learn about fucking Dashites, which is another one of the things in the story that's fun to talk about. So the Enclave, when they find dissenters and treason to the cause of the Enclave, they don't kill them, they exile them, but when they do so, they chemically burn their cutie marks off, which is ridiculous, like, absurd, and their entire family is basically completely shamed, so, like, it's a completely disastrous thing, which, I mean, like, that's an actually, like, pretty cool fascist thing, and, like it's that's a good way to make the bad guy seem evil. The shitty thing about it, though, of course, is that Glory doesn't like Dashites, because, like, the whole thing with Dashites is that they, like, their great treason typically is, like, hey, what if we, like, helped people besides ourselves? Or, like, maybe this, like, militant fascist regime isn't a big, like, it's such a great idea. But, like, Glory is like, no, they're just selfish, because they're ruining their families, like, livelihoods by, like, being branded as a Dashite. And she again calls out Rainbow Dash as a character because she hates that, like, she tried to do stuff. And, like, made the line that, like, if she just waited 20 years, we would have been much more prepared to do this thing. And it's, like, it's such a, like, again, like, such neolib garbage of, like, no, we're just ready. Like get everything, get all our affairs sorted. People are dying, but, you know, we don't actually care that much.
No, you should get your own house in order before you criticize someone else's very thinly coded, like, never ever complain about the system because it's a perpetually retreating goalpost. Can you provide us some spoilers? Does she, like, ever get proven, like, wrong about this?
Oh,
like, ever accept that, like, oh, maybe I've drunk an awful lot more Kool-Aid than I thought I had?
There is a really cool scene in a couple of chapters from now where, like, she has a huge, like, she freaks out on BJ because she was like, how could you, like, she basically is like, the Enclave is good, like, what are you talking about? And, like, she then gets fucking branded as a Dashite for incredibly complicated reasons. and she's forced to like live out the rest of her life in shame and ruin her family. And she slowly starts to come to realize that like the organization that she's been working for is the bad guys. The shitty thing though is that like that's cool and all, but Sombra still has a bad problem of kind of painting the Enclave as bad actors controlling fairly decent people.
It's a shitty, lazy way to like have a character. Like it is a really forced way to have a character grow, and arguably it is a way for a character to discover something about like the world without actually ever growing. Because like she only recognizes the problem when it is her problem. Mm-hmm. Which kind of implies that like nothing else would ever have dissuaded her from thinking the system is just.
Mm-hmm. Except for personal trauma.
Because the like sort of moral statement, the like her core agreement with it is one of selfishness, is one of like, well, look, like of course this happened to you. You prioritized the well-being of not the Enclave over the Enclave. And so like it's kind of a huge bummer that the only thing that like makes her question that notion is it's suffering the consequences of the veil of ignorance doesn't mean anything to her until she realizes, I could be on the receiving end of this? That had never occurred to me. Okay, now I recognize it as bad.
Now it is a problem. Yeah, and even then, when she gets branded, she still like ultimately forgives the Enclave because she gets branded for fake reasons. Like, it was a bad actor shaming her for complicated political reasons, and not that just system is broken.
Okay, so branding as an institution, fine. It just needs to...
Yeah, it just needs to be used on the right people.
We just need the right kings. Anyway, moving on. This is where we're talking about events and stories far future. Yoda would scald us. Well-written Yoda would still scald us terribly.
stay tuned for that shit. But yeah, anyways, we then get to meet one of my favorite characters in this story. The characters are so awful in the story that I have to cling on to the couple of people that are enjoyable to listen to talk. It turns out that despite Lancer being a really good shot, he couldn't possibly kill 10 zebras in the span of 10 seconds kind of thing. A pair of zebras lived. It was a zebra, a mare and her daughter, who were both deaf. It doesn't really matter. Named Sakashi, and she's awesome. I love this character so much because she unfortunately has the problem of being kind of the like the cliche of like magical black person, where like she doesn't necessarily do anything in the story, but she constantly imparts wisdom to the protagonist in a way that like, because there's zebras and the way zebras are coded in the story is very like coded that way. But she talks entirely in parables and stories, and she's like a really fun character because she like doesn't let the oppression of like the oppressiveness of the waste like get her down. Because in her own like ideology, like being relentlessly happy is essentially being rebellious to the like fucked up state of the things. Like especially like the zebra remnants are incredibly totalitarian, and her whole thing is like, well, then I'm just gonna make fun of you all the time and laugh at you, like, because like that way you have no power over me, you have no control over my like sense of state, and she's just awesome. Like she's just a fun character. But
Amuse would be proud. You go, zebra girl. Imagine Sisyphus happy.
Yes, she's great. I'll get back to her in a second, but a lot of this chapter is then taken up with a memory orb. Yay, memory orbs! Fi's favorite part of the stories.
For new listeners, that is sarcasm. They are the worst.
This is Fi's sarcasm song. But yeah, we get a memory orb because I don't remember why, but BJ just takes the memory orb and goes through it, and we find out this was Gorgon's memory orb, and we get to find out a bunch of crazy nonsense. First of all, Gorgon is apparently at least 200 years old because he used to be a soldier in the Equestrian military. a Pegasus by the name of Stonewing. So he could fly not because he was, like, modified, but he was just a Pegasus who got turned into a stone monster thing. We get a bunch of characters who are not named, but, like, I know them all because, of course, I do. But they're known as McIntosh's Marauders, which were an elite platoon. They're an elite platoon of military horses that all served underneath McIntosh, the big hero of the story. Yeah. Just find something funny with that.
Sarge, we're taking on more casualties than we can handle. Yep.
Yeah, basically. But yeah, it's a weird cavalcade. It's the ragtag crew of tightly knit like familial horses, sort of stereotype. They're pretty fun as like a kind of like aside. But the shitty thing about them is that literally every single one of them is critical to the story. So they become less fun and more annoying later on in the story when it's like, oh, another one of the McIntosh Marauders is related in this plot line. Cool. Like, not a single one is irrelevant. It's actually kind of annoying. But yeah, but we learn about Stonewing. We learn that he had a thing for Rainbow Dash, and this is when like this isn't really important, but it's just a thing that sticks out that like Rainbow Dash is gay in this story, and people always make allusions to it. But yeah, then she comes out of the memory orb to people fighting over something, and it turns out that like. That other Pecos pony that I talked about that got saved from the scorpions, turns out that they have the Raider disease, so no one knows what to do about it, and then BJ just makes the decision to euthanize her. Well, sorry. Euthanize would imply that like they all had like a decision about her killing them. No, the story decides to take the decision out of the equation by having Tumbleweed, who's the person with the Raider disease, straight up attack BJ, therefore giving her justification to exterminate her. This really isn't important again, but it's just more baggage for BJ to feel sorry for herself about. Oh man, and then we're almost at the end of this chapter for this week, because fucking nothing happens in the story except for some conversations. We have this big, dumb, crazy scene where they find the guy that had been running the mine, like the slaver that had been running the mine. 21 and BJ have some conversations about talking about like what I want to do with them, and it's revealed that BJ, 21 hooked up the mine leader with like a bomb collar, because it's how they've been like keeping the slaves in line, is that they like have a bomb collar that's hooked to a dead man switch, so like if they kill the slavers, they'll kill them.
All right,
it'll blow their heads off. But he hooked it to the mine leader, and then there's a really nonsensical, crazy conversation where 21 is like super murder happy about wanting to kill this guy for the sake of justice. BJ insists that she's not an executioner, which is a thing that the story constantly draws the line in the sand about. Like it's actually like a critical theme of the story, at least from Sombra's perspective, that like BJ may kill people, but she is not going to just execute people like wholesale. She doesn't feel like she has the right to like decide the lives of people if they don't try to kill her first. But yeah, she gets a big conversation with the slaves about what to do. And she tries to convince them to like not do it, and sadly, of course, the scene ends with her leaving, thinking she might have convinced them, and then hearing the explosion of the man's head popping off. One last thing we get is we actually meet Sakashi proper. BJ has a conversation with her that is just kind of just fun to read, because again, Sakashi just reads out her sense of ethos of just like, be happy, the wasteland can't keep me down. She tells a story of the like for want of a nail kind of parable, like the, but kind of it's really framed as a story of like of a hero who tries to do everything to help people and feel bad when like they feel they haven't done enough, even though like everyone else around them can see that like them trying their best is the thing. Like it's a pretty like naked like story, but that's actually kind of the point about Sakashi, is like she tells moralizing stories because they're so obvious what the moral is, because she's trying to like get people to think about like their actions and stuff. Like Summer just kind of accidentally wrote this really fun character, and I can't help but like always sing her praise whenever she's in the scene. All the characters should be asking when Sakashi's not in the scene.
Where's Sakashi?
She's just fun. She like I don't know. She's a nice antithesis to characters like Lancer, who are just like they're just like jihad in pony form. Like,
that's like sort of the core tragedy of the magical black person as a trope is that like we would all prefer just to see a movie about this person.
Mm-hmm.
But they're pure like they don't get like an arc. They don't their story revolve. Their sole purpose is to enrich the life of the very white person or white coated person in this case.
Yes, and BJ has white fur, so she's literally white coated.
I didn't realize that. I remember that she has like red hair.
Yeah, she has red and black hair.
Red and black hair. I assume that. Oh man, you know what? I'm putting my foot down. No, she doesn't.
It's an off white.
She's a black horse with like red streaks in her mane. And you can't stop me. No one can stop me. Fight me, Somber.
Somber. So that's actually like a freshening thing before I end this chapter moving to the next that I always want to talk. Like, I always want to complain about to people about Fall Equestria. Fall Equestria's protagonist does not have a confirmed design. Like specifically Little Pip does not have a confirmed design because she's an author insert thing that could be anything, kind of like the protagonist of Fallout, the original story, could be a multitude of characters. But, like, one guy drew fan art that everyone liked and decided that was the canon design forever, and then that entire design is based around it. And it's a shitty design because she's, like, gray fur and brown hair, and it just kind of, like, sucks aesthetically, and I always complain about it, though, even though it doesn't, like... Like, I've been carrying this torch for a decade, and I'm going to carry it for another 30. Like, it's... I'm never going to let go of this problem. It's always been such a really big sticking point with me. But yeah, anyways, 21, like, gets really frustrated with Sakashi because, like P21 is just nothing but rage. So, like, he can't handle Sakashi just being, like, upbeat. Because he's like, you're a slave. Like, what do you have happy for? It's like, well, I'm not dead. I'm free now. Yeah, like,
also
like,
not a slave anymore. That's just a pretty good up.
Yeah, and he just, like, can't handle it. Like, he can't wrap his brain around it. Which is kind of awesome. Like, it's kind of awesome that, like, I like having there being a character who's, like, actually, like, doesn't even necessarily call him out, but her existence, like, disproves 21's, like, incredibly hated, like, hate-filled ethos. But, yeah, one last sort of, like, detail we see is that we find out that, like, the skeletal cowboy horse that BJ had been dreaming of, she, like, sees him across the road. When they're walking by minecarts, and, like, he's real, I guess. We don't know what that actually means for now, but yeah, she starts seeing him now in being, like, in the real world, I guess.
I mean, did she, like, win her game against it, like, or was it?
No, she's done nothing but lose. So, like. Yeah, it's important. I'm only bringing it up because he's in the story a lot, so I was like confused about when he initially like popped up in the story, and I guess it's this part. Like, this is the like this is literally the bullet that caught like starts the whole thing. But yeah, so that's like that's the end of chapter 10. Basically, nothing happened again. But yeah, so you know, go to the lobby, get yourself some snacks, read a book, take a nap. Go out for a run, get some exercise. I don't know, do something with yourself.
Take in some good literature.
Yeah, read something fun.
Maybe take a brief break, listen to some other podcast other than a fucking crime podcast, because there's a lot of fucking dubious like moral like
implications of true crime podcasts.
Yeah, that are bad. So don't do that.
Yeah,
do just about anything but that. Pet a dog.
Pet a cat.
Pet a cat. Insist that it's a dog. tell your cat she's a good, good girl.
Yes. Maybe feed it a treat. But yeah, we'll move right on to chapter 11, Peace, which is jarring in a way that is kind of interesting. We hit the next chapter of BJ waking up alone in a cellar on a cot with none of her gear, her friends nowhere to be seen. it's kind of like wild, the jump that happens here. She's disoriented about what happened, what's going on, and she gets some bedside manner by a black horse with basically a religious symbol on his flank named Priest, who is also a kind of fun character.
Mm-hmm. Is that what your mama called you?
Priest? I don't know. Yeah, you look like you're going to believe in God, so I'm going to call you Priest. Is that your name, your occupation?
Yes, I was born with great purpose.
He's something of a fun character because he's like sort of like soft-spoken, nice religious horse that's just kind of like nice to everybody. He's a nice break from the oppressive cruelty that every character seems to exhibit up to this point. He elucidates her on her situation. She is in the town of Chapel, which is the like home territory of the Crusaders. It's their like faction home. It's also pointed out that she is wildly off course from where she was. Essentially, like Brimstone's Fall is like up to the north of Hoovington, and she's like deep into the south, and much closer to where her home stable was. All of a sudden, we get a little bit of a description of the town itself. It's essentially like a big church and then a bunch of like small bombed out buildings that have been converted over by the Crusaders to live in. And it's right next to a bridge that leads directly into the core, which is important for later into this chapter. He explains that the Crusaders just sort of found her on the road and they dragged her back to here in a daze. And the reason why that was is that apparently she used a memory orb at some point. Like we don't know when. And it was trapped because apparently, like, there are memory orbs that have information on them that would be considered dangerous to the state for people to know. So they have passwords that are required to be able to unlock them. And if not, they can knock you unconscious all the way up to actually just straight up killing you because they just, like, turn off your brain's autonomic functions while you're trapped in the memory orb and you just die in a dream state, which is actually super nightmarish. Like, I complained before about memory orbs only really being for exposition, but, like, this is a rare example of, like, actually using them for anything but. We also, they have a conversation with Priest about, because he hands her some healing potions that are weirdly grayed out, because healing potions are usually deep purple in color. And we get explained that there is some sort of strange radiation-like effect in the story that's unique to Footsburg called enervation, which seems to drain out the effects of healing power, like healing magic. So healing potions will stop working the more exposed to innervation they work, and similar effects will also start affecting people if they're around it for too long. We then get a big old box of exposition that I kind of just have to skip for lots of reasons, but we find out that like there's a someone at some point made a wasteland how to survive book called the Wasteland Survival Guide. And there's a bunch of her flipping through it. And it's mostly just like a lot of backfill about things in the way, like it's setting up stuff for later plot points. Like it introduces all of the towns and who controls them. The only really important ones right now for our purposes is Chapels run by Crusaders, Megamarts run by the Finders, same with Paradise and Flank, which is the one that Caprice runs. And the only other one, really important one right now, is the arena is where the Reapers are. And it says to avoid that place at all costs, unless you're an idiot. They have a conversation about the Reapers that this leads into. We find out that Deus Ex Machina is Zebra, apparently, for the god of the machine. Something I forgot about zebras in this story, in this setting, is that zebras are Roman, essentially. Like, all of their aesthetics are incredibly, like Roman, like, legionnaire armor and stuff like that, so it's just kind of all over the place aesthetically.
Sure.
Sure. We then actually get like so something that like that they kind of explains here is that Reapers aren't like the Raiders that have the Raider disease aren't the same as Reapers. Like Reapers are like kind of untouched by this disease and they're just naturally born good killers that have all flocked together to be part of the this badass faction.
Sure. And again, there's only there is precisely 100 Reapers. Yes.
Mm-hmm. But they keep control of all the gangs and the Raiders in the territory. And when promising ones manage to kill their way into the Reapers, they become part of it. Like Reapers are the things everyone else aspires to be if you're like a killer, basically. We actually get the full list of all of the four horses of the apocalypse, of which Deus is part of. So the four horsemen of the apocalypse were Deus, Gorgon, and two characters we haven't met yet named Rampage and Psycho Shy. The last one being the worst thing ever. Just let that sink in.
Nope.
Yeah, you're just going to reject that out of hand.
Yep.
While they're having this conversation, some pilgrims show up, as priest refers to them as, to stay in the chapel, because apparently they keep people who are on hard times. One last thing that comes out of the Wasteland Survival Guide that's not related to this story, but it's in the other story, and it's kind of like an interesting thing that's, again, ripped off of Fallout New Vegas, but fuck it. While everywhere else got nuked, the zebras knew they couldn't nuke the capital, Canterlot, because it was too well protected. So instead they released like basically a dirty bomb of one of the most nightmarish like chemical warfare things I've ever I've seen in a story, which is probably lifted from something, but like I don't know the reference. It's a magic cloud called Pink Cloud that destabilizes your molecular structure. It is essentially what it is. Anything you're touching becomes part of you, basically. If you're unlucky, you can just slip into the concrete, and now you and the concrete are one. And the only way that they can hypothetically get you out is to cut you out. In the main story, they end up having to go to Canterlot, and it's pretty garish because there's a bunch of just zombified ghouls that are Pink Cloud ghouls. So they're all just like half them are like in the road, and the lucky ones are ambulatory, but equally completely nuts. But yeah, this is only really important to set up the concept of Pink Cloud Ghouls, which Pink Cloud Ghouls are tougher ghouls that are basically immortal and can only be killed in special ways. And they also breathe the stuff. Like, they physically exhale Pink Cloud.
Right.
A lot of this is just set up for later stuff. Like, that's what this chapter and the next couple of chapters are going to be, is me just, like, boringly reading out lore detail. So they deal with the pilgrims. They go to sleep in the chapel while everyone's resting up. BJ goes to the shop in the post office. We get to meet my least favorite character in the whole fucking story, a character named Charity, her name's ironic because she's capitalism as a bratty 10-year-old. Everything she does, she prices, and it's supposed to be endearing. But it's just insufferable. It's insufferable and annoying every time she's in the scene, and I just end up having to glaze her over. I just hate her. I hate her so much. But she always taxes Blackjack for money. And the reason why I hate her is because the story like is really nice to her. Like they're always, it's always like, oh, that scamp charging people extra money for things they need. Oh, isn't she adorable? Like it's like those people need that water though. Like, that's not endearing. That's
yeah, she's holding like vital things ransom from people for like really petty personal gain. Like,
yes,
I mean it would be cute if she like it would be maybe marginally cute if she existed in a Ponyverse that didn't also have like nightmare like heavy metal like pavement zombies and like
yes. And a Mortan pony and all this crazy nonsensical horseshit. Like it's actually like deeply unethical that she's this way.
Yeah, no, this is like she is just shoot her in the head immediately evil. Like she is worse than a screeching raider horse. Because at least a screeching like insane raider horse like is honest. Anyway.
Yeah, a raider is just going to kill you. She's going to tax you and then, like to death, essentially. But yeah, she swindles Blackjack out of a very little amount of ammo because BJ's completely out of like she's completely out of uniform. She has nothing. She's none of her equipment. She decides to go for a walk at a chapel to like clear her head of all the shit of her friends being gone. Because her friends are out of the story for a while. Like we get to have Blackjack solo adventures for a while, which I mean, like they're fun because at least there's not all the dumb hand wringing about like, oh, should we do this? Is it morally right to do this? It's like she just fights people. And it's like, all right. But we get because they're so close to the core, we get a proper description of it finally.
that isn't just like mythologized. The core is absurd. It's New York. Like it's the constant. She talks about like the monolithic nature of the skyscrapers, and I love how the skyscrapers are like. There's two skyscrapers specifically, Skybolt Tower and I don't remember the other one. That are so fucking huge that they like break the like cloud cover, which I always thought was like a really cool like visual image of just these ridiculous buildings so big that you can't see the tops of them. We end up in a museum somehow. Like I can't remember reading over the scene, but like she just kind of like ends up in a museum of natural history because like I guess she needs something to do in this part. I guess you can make the argument that she needs equipment, but she doesn't really like seem to think about it too hard. She's just kind of in a bizarre sort of like lonely haze. Which I mean, when you're lonely and have no friends, I guess the first place to go is a museum. We get a little bit of a hint of a character when she's getting into the museum. She catches for like a split second a character in the darkness who is a vague silhouette of a gigantic horse that has wings and a horn, which is important for later. So stay tuned. She tours around the museum for a while. This is a ton of backstory shit. Some of this I'm just going to skip at a hand, but certain ones I have to because like I realized upon rereading them and planning on skipping them that they're actually like critical to a person's incredibly convoluted backstory. In the backstory for a few chapters now, there's been newspaper clippings that they've been finding of the like of someone known as the Angel Killer, who was some sort of serial killer in the past who killed a bunch of children, and the hero cop that stopped her but was like fatally wounded in doing so. That wouldn't matter except for, again, it's part of someone's incredibly convoluted backstory, so I'm making note of them now. We get a little like tour of the history of Footsburg and how it was created. It was originally a zebra colony that exploded because a meteorite hit it.
That threw me. You're usually when you say that a city exploded, oh, a massive increase in population. No, the other thing.
No, it exploded. It physically exploded. We get a bit of an explanation behind the zebra's red marking thing is that, like, in zebra historical tradition, red is the mark of traitors. So, like, the red marked zebras are, like, traitors to the empire. That's why they magically changed themselves to be that color.
Okay.
Yeah. It's just lore all the way down, folks.
Well, I mean, lore that doesn't, like... I guess... I don't know. I guess they're owning it, like, that, like deplorables? I don't know. Like, that doesn't seem like... Like, when you, like... When you feel the cause, like, feel like there's cause to defect from, like, your side... Most of the time, people who do that don't, like, tattoo traitor on their own forehead. That seems like a weird thing to do.
They don't sew a purple... they don't sew the six-pointed star onto their fucking face. But yeah, it exploded. Then horses colonized the area from the zebras. And, like, Hoofington is essentially sits right on the border between the two empires. And it's constantly been an area of contention. When the war broke out, specifically the war broke out because a school got bombed. When the war broke out, one of the first places hit was Footsburg got firebombed by the zebras, which all of the horses there took that as incentive to rebuild the place better than ever. This is when we get more of Golden Blood's secret plan all along shit, because the person that headed the like reformation of Footsburg was Golden Blood, who I guess was an important political figure in the city. He does a big giant fuck off speech that I refuse to like memorize because it's stupid, but it's really fucked up and horrible because it basically really 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 leans into jingoism and propaganda in a way that is incredibly like soft on, like it does not discuss the fact that he's basically like, yeah, zebras are savages and we need to exterminate them. But we get the phrase Hoofington rises because the hoof rises. That's why it's called Hoofington, by the way.
Footsburg, the foot rises.
Yes.
Ever higher, higher our steps.
in an almost goose-like fashion.
Yes, that's the whole reason why it's called Hoofington, is because it's the hoof rises, which is constantly used as a thematic like thing in the story. We get mentions of Golden Blood running a
High Step City.
Oh yeah.
Oh,
the Bigfoot Town.
Wait a minute. So who? All right. Give me a little bit of a spoiler. I'm begging you. Is it? Please. I need assurance that villains are the ones who keep assuring us that the foot rises.
No, everyone does. The hoof rises is used initially as a thing, a parallel of it. Everything getting worse in the hoof, and then BJ starts parodying it, and then close to the end of the story, BJ regurgitates a version of this speech and ends it with the hoof rises, because it's supposed to be a parallel about how them trying to fix what's been fucked up to this point, but it kind of, because of who said it and why it's being said, it kind of cements BJ as like the de facto fash leader of this like ragtag like army that she has to like go to war with, because this story has a fucking like Ninja Summit style war arc at the end of it. It's fucking crazy. This story fucking goes places.
So everything went wrong because we failed in our glorious national ambitions.
Yes. We failed to unite the hoof. It wasn't that this was a bad bad plan the whole time.
Oh my god. Oh man, this whole fucking thing is so blatantly crypto. Like, holy shit.
Yeah, it really is. It's nuts. It's real nuts. Anyways, the only other really important thing that happens, the two other stupid things that are important that happen at this museum, is BJ spies a cool katana, basically, in a glass case that really wants to get. Like, it's my favorite thing. It's a dumb, magic, stupid sword, and she just, like, salivates over it when she first sees it, and it's in all description and all fan art people have ever done, though I don't recommend looking fan art up for this series because you'll spoil yourself about details. Like, there are visual spoilers in BJ's design for later chapters, so I don't recommend it. But she basically has a katana in later parts of the story.
That she chops up watermelons in her in her front yard with, like...
Don't talk about it. As shitty as this chapter has been in the last chapter before, we actually get some cool combat that is like kind of interesting to talk about. So BJ has been getting hilariously drunk this whole time because she's got nothing better to do, and she found a bottle of whiskey in somebody's locker. But it turns out some bounty hunters caught wind of that she was going to be in this museum, and they try to claim her bounty. And there is kind of a fun exchange to the start of this fight where she has that thing where she's like, she's so drunk she's like completely like disinterested in the situation, and she's just kind of like she's just kind of like looking at her bottle being sad that it's all almost empty while they're like menacing her like, oh, we're gonna kill you, we're gonna take your bounty. And then she just glasses a guy with the bottle and then stabs him with all the parts of it, which is kind of a fun like image. Despite being a goofy pastel horses.
Yeah, she takes their guns. It's a pretty classic action movie, like just bean them over the head and then cause the like sugar glass to break and then stab them with it.
Yeah. It's marginally cooler because she telekinetically like stabs him with the broken pieces as well, doing so. But she takes his guns and proceeds to murder the rest of them. And it's actually a fairly compelling like fight. Like, Sombra's getting better at this is the point I'm trying to make. Like, they're not snore fests, and there's BJ does more smart, cool things in fights that help like help sell the fact that she's supposed to be really good at killing people. Like the thing I keep saying is that Sombra does not need to keep telling us that BJ is good at killing people. We don't need her to be constantly pat on the back for it, because we can just see it happen in the story. One of my favorite scenes in this whole story is a really, an actually genuinely really cool fight where she murders a bunch of, like, really decked out characters up to that point in a really fun way. But that won't be for months, so stay tuned. But yeah, she murders most of them, and she decides to take pity on a couple of them that, like, give up. They give up because she broke one of the guy's legs and shot the other one's dick off, so... which, for the prose perspective, is kind of fun, because, like, since she doesn't know any of their names, she just refers to them in the way that she's injured them. So, like, by the end of it, she's talking to Broken Legs and Nick Jewels, which I thought was kind of funny.
That's a cute action movie trope. It's a thing I can see Brock Sanson doing, so I'm fine with it.
Yeah. Total disregard for your character. I don't even know who you are, so you're busted dick now. Until I say otherwise. Anyways, so we're almost done with our text for tonight. We hit the very end scene of the story where BJ is being melancholy about the concept of graveyards, because in Stable 99 you don't have, like, people don't get buried, obviously, they get fed into the machine. So, like, the concept of her experiencing, like, mourning and death is kind of sort of hard for her to handle. And it's kind of, like, it's compelling, to say the least. We have I forgot about this, and I forgot to talk about this, and I'm sorry to everyone. Like, this is a pretty core theme to the story. So, and this is actually an interesting bit of world building that is, like, I think cleverer than Sonnenberg intended for it. Really, really early on in the story, Watcher talked about the concept of virtues. He's looking for people that are particularly virtuous, and he describes virtues as, like, the thing that keeps you going, like some critical element of you that you can't sacrifice to the waste to keep yourself, like, sane and good. It's an echo to the original story talking about the idea of virtues, and virtues are actually super clever. Because they're not about, like, Watcher doesn't actually care about people's virtues. He's looking for specific ones because he's trying to find the elements of friendship, which is a thing from the story.
Yeah,
like, he's trying to.
Yeah, it's from the first episode.
Yeah,
and in fact, like, as far as I know, only ever referenced in the, like, premiere episode of each season.
He's trying to, because he's convinced those can fix the waste. So he's actually screening people to try and find people that are qualified to become the elements of harmony. And that's actually, like, super cool. As, like, it's clever writing, but that's from K-Cat, so, like, that's part of it.
Whoops.
But I don't think Sombra intended this, but no one uses the word virtues except for Watcher in these stories. So Priest probably knows Watcher in some way, and this is a really, really subtle way of implying that. And that's really, really, really cool, but I don't necessarily think that was actually intended. It's just something I noticed that's like, oh, that's a very loaded word that only one other character uses in this story. It's a cool parallel. They talk about virtues, and Priest considers his virtue to be mercy, and BJ just kind of, like, tries to think about what her virtue actually is. And that's a hanging thread for a huge chunk of the story, is her trying to figure out what her virtue is. They then go to see the pilgrims off, and everyone's being really weird, hush-hush weird about it, because pilgrims are the sort of nice word priests use for people that want to die from the waste, and their chosen method of self-execution is to go into the core, because the core has defense systems that will instantly vaporize you if you get too close to it. So the bridge that they go into is a bridge that's called mercy. Like, that's the thing. It's a big thematic thing. So they walk out onto it to be vaporized, and that's our final shot, is, like, BJ desperately trying to get to them and them, like, accepting their fates and turning into red ash, essentially. But yeah, that's our chapter. It kind of ends on a sort of like more restrained sad note than, like, we've
yeah, no, it's pretty it's bleak in a more, like, yeah,
in a more human way. Like I can identify with that better than, like, oh, I have to come to terms with that I exterminated 40 characters that I never even met. Like, but yeah, that's our two chapters for the week. Weird, you got any notes for me? Anything you want to clarify?
One thing that stands out for me, for whatever weird reason, is that, like, schools seem to come up a bunch.
Mm-hmm.
For whatever, like it's a concept that, like, as of this episode, like, standing out to me. One of the first places they go is a school that is, like, has a bunch of children in it who are being held hostage,
and then come across this like hospital that's like set up like a kindergarten nursery, and my brain is skipping a beat because I could swear that I've heard the word school in at least one more context, but
the Brimstones Fall, like they were hanging out in a library / school for a while.
Okay, yeah.
And specifically they were pretending to be children while they were doing it.
Oh yeah, no, they had to bypass a bunch of killbots by pretending to be students within a school. And then we come to find out that like Goosestepville's origin story has to do with a school being attacked. So like
I never really thought about that, yeah.
So that seems that strikes like keeps coming up. Like
yeah, it seems like the kind of thing that like the author is doing intentionally, which is would be cool. Like as much as I hate Somber, I would like to give him some points for writing. Like
or Somber started writing this when like they were 17 and like
yeah, and schools are just really on their brain.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, if I was to be cynical, it's probably just using like the areas that they know versus like as frames of reference. But yeah, if I'm being kind to them, it's an interesting parallel. Like a lot of catastrophe seems to somehow deal with schools a lot. Yeah, I don't know, I never really thought about that.
But yeah, no, tragically, it's a tragedy. I feel the need to retire Footsburg because we now know that its true origin is Goosestepville.
Yes, it's Goosestepville.
Goose stepping on into the future.
Fascism of the future.
All these whiners with their low power levels thinking that goose stepping is led us to destruction. When the truth is, we just didn't goose step hard enough.
Yeah.
So, dear listener, please press the thumbs up icon, the hearts, the stars. All the positive signifiers on whatever.
Give us a review on iTunes would be a really great one.
That'll help a lot. Definitely need enormously. Those. Yeah. Even if typing is too much of a burden, I can feel that. Like I feel your pain. Like I'm there with you. It takes no effort at all to just go into the like click to the store link and then press that fifth star to your right, the rightmost star. Click that. I beg of you. And please tell us what you think. We're excited for your feedback, good or bad.
We'd love to hear from you. Tell us how much of a shit I am for being so pedantic about the details of a story that is a fanfic of a fanfic.
But yeah, no, I leave you, listener, with the image of with a horse telekinetically fleeing Katana, telling you that while you were masturbating, she was studying the blade, with her glowing eyes just behind a pair of rad dragon-themed shades. Because this has all been a terrible mistake.